time starts anew, and with a shiny dew, everything's covered. The sunny sky is clear, the darkness is not here, the new day is coming.
Hi, and welcome to the Salty Canadian Podcast. I'm your host, Sarah. I'll provide everywhere I can be found at the end of the podcast. So today I'm going to be reading a story from True Canadian Unsolved Mystery by Ed Butt. And this one's called The Scoli Mystery, Peterborough Horror. David Scoli, Old Dave as his neighbors called him, lived alone on his farm at Otonabee, about 2 miles, 3.2 kilometers from Peterborough, Ontario. He had never married, and his only living relative was his sister. Scoli had always worked hard, and his farm was prosperous. Because he had no family to support, he had saved a considerable sum of money. He was frugal, but no one could call him a miser. Old Davy was always willing to help out a neighbor in need. About 1888, Scoli's neighbor, John G. Weir, hired an Irish immigrant named Thomas Gray as a farmhand. He put Gray and his family up in a small cottage that was very near David Scoli's house. Thomas Gray was described as a stupid-looking, with small gray eyes, close-cropped black hair, and a brown mustache. However, his wife, Hazy, was said to be a sharp, active little woman, bright as a new sixpence and sharp as a razor. She was good-looking, with a bright, clear complexion. Those who knew Hazy said she was a woman of strong passions and violent temper. Thomas and Hazy had 5 children, Thomas Jr., Annie, Hazy, Mary, and George. Old Davy became very friendly with the Grays' children, especially little Tommy, a boy some called precious, but whom others found obnoxious. Tommy was often at Scoli's house. Sometimes his mother would go along with him to bake the old man's bread and to tidy up for him. After a few months, John Weir decided that he was not satisfied with Thomas Gray's work and fired him. That meant the family had to vacate the cottage. Kind-hearted Scoli gave Thomas a job on his farm and said the family could live with him in his house. The Grays accepted without hesitation. The arrangement worked well. The Grays had a fine house to live in with room for the children. Thomas had work. Old Davy no longer had to worry about cooking and housekeeping. Most of all, he had people to keep him company in his old age. Things went so well, in fact, that Scoli was receptive to an idea that was presented to him by Thomas, but quite likely was thought of by Hazy. If Scoli would sign his farm over to Thomas, he could continue to live there in comfort for the rest of his days as a virtual member of the family. Tom would take care of most of the work. Scoli had a lawyer draw up the appropriate papers for the 2 men to sign, and the deal was done. For about 2 years, there were no problems. Old Davy was like a grandfather to the children. The old man couldn't have been happier. He didn't realize that Thomas and Hazy were waiting impatiently for him to die. Scoli was in his early 60s, an advanced age at that time, but he showed no signs of failing health. Scoli was fit and hale as he has ever been. He even walked into Peterborough every day to buy his newspaper. Hazy's sister Mary lived with her husband William McGregor on a farm about a half mile from the Scoli place. Hazy began to complain to Mary that it seemed as the old baby would never die. "He is likely to live as long as I will," she said. She talked of shooting or poisoning the old man, then said that would attract the attention of the law. He needed some means of getting rid of Scully that wouldn't leave any evidence. Mary told Hesse that such talk could get her arrested. Then old Davy had an accident. He was standing in front of the house when a flower pot fell, or was dropped, from a second floor window. It struck him on the head and tore a bloody gash in his scalp. Scully recovered from the injury, though under the care of neighbors, not his adopted family. Hesse blamed the accident on one of her children who, she said, had been playing with the flower pot and clumsily dropped it. Soon after that incident, Hesse let Scully know exactly where he stood. She told the old man that looking after him was more trouble than the farm was worth. Scully subsequently told Thomas that he would pay any sum the Greys asked, within a reason, to nullify their legal contract. Thomas demanded $1,300. Scully considered that exorbitant and refused. Thomas went to see the lawyer in Peterborough. After listening to Gray's litany of woes, the lawyer advised him to honor the agreement he had made with Scully. For a time, a semblance of normalcy seemed to return to the Scully Gray household. If there were quarrels, the neighbors didn't hear of it, but Hesse's impatience was growing. In November of 1893, she told Mary that the winter to come would be the old brute's last. She was going to cut off his head and then burn the house down with the body in it. Mary said that if Hesse did such a thing, she would hang, or else some innocent person would be blamed for the crime. Hesse asked how the hell anyone would know what happened with the place in ashes. Then she said, "What the hell do I care who is blamed for it, so long as I keep Tom out of it?" That, at least, is what Mary McGregor testified later. About 2 o'clock on the morning of February 23rd, 1894, David Scully's house caught fire. Thomas Gray was visiting his brother in Madoc, about 40 miles, 64.3 kilometers away. Hesse put her children, barefoot and barely clothed, out the window into the snow. Then she climbed out herself. At this time, Hesse was pregnant with her 6th child. Hesse told the children to hurry to the McGregor farm half a mile away and alert their aunt and uncle. The home of another farmer, Zacchaeus Burnham, was only 120 yards, 109.7 meters away. But she did not go there to call for help. She, too, headed for the more distant McGregor place. Hesse met her brother-in-law partway. Roused by the children, McGregor had hurried towards the burning house. When he saw Hesse, he asked her where Scully was. She said she had shouted to him to get out, but she hadn't seen him. She thought he was still in the house. When McGregor reached the house, he kicked in the front door. The whole lower floor was ablaze. There was no chance of anyone getting out that way. McGregor knew that Scully's bedroom was at the front of the house on the second floor. He looked up from the yard and saw that the flames had not yet reached that part of the house. He called Scully's name. If he could get the old man to come to the window, he might convince him to jump into the snow. But there was no sign of old Davy. Zacchaeus Burnham was running over from his house, but there was nothing he and McGregor could do. By dawn, as other neighbors gathered in the yard, the house had been totally destroyed. The men threw buckets of water on the smoking ruins and then began to probe through the debris in search of the charred remains of David Scully. What they found wasn't what they expected. They found Scully's body under a pile of ash and wreckage, not at the front of the house, where it should have been if the old man had been in bed, but in the cellar that had been dug under the back part of the house. The body was laying in straw mattress and was covered with 2 blankets and a quilt. It was dressed in underwear and a shirt. Old Davy's hands were folded over his breast, indicating that he had passed away painlessly in his sleep. Neither the bedding nor the clothing had been burned. Parts of the feet had been burned off, but otherwise The corpse showed little evidence of having been in an inferno. Not even the hair on the chest and arms was singed. What horrified these looking on was the fact that his head was missing. About 6 inches, 15.2 centimeters, of bone, blackened at the end, like a piece of cordwood, protruded from the neck. The men sifted through the ashes, but could not find old Davy's head. Not even so much as a jawbone. The coroner, a doctor, and an undertaker all examined the body. Each noted that there was no blood on the clothing or bedding. The coroner's inquest concluded that the head had been separated from the body by action of the fire and had completely consumed. The coroner's jury concluded that further investigation was unnecessary. David Scully went to his grave in his shirt and underwear without a head. The Gray family lived for a while with the McGregors. Thomas spoke of rebuilding the house on what was now his own property. But in spite of the coroner's findings, people in the area were whispering murder. 4 months after the fire, Thomas sold the farm. He packed up his wife and children and moved to the United States. But the departure of the Grays did not stop the gossip mill. Among those spreading tales were William and Mary McGregor. Because the coroner in Peterborough had not reported anything unusual to the provincial government in Toronto, some 15 months passed before the Attorney General's office heard of the suspicious circumstances of the fire in Otonabee. When the story finally reached officials' ears, questions were raised. Why was the body in the wrong part of the house? How could the head have been separated from the trunk? Why hadn't Hessie Gray roused Scully when she knew the house was burning? Why hadn't she gone straight to the Burnham's house, only 120 yards away, rather than her sister's house, half a mile distant? Old Scully's body was exhumed and examined by John Cavan, a professor of pathology at the University of Toronto. The professor was not at all convinced that Scully was still alive when the fire started. A warrant was made out for the arrest of Thomas and Hessie Gray. The task of locating the Gray family fell to the provincial detective John Wilson Murray, the man who came to be known as Canada's greatest detective. Murray was an outstanding investigator, though he embellished things somewhat in his memoirs. However, he was probably telling the truth when he described his experience during the Gray case. Finding the family was easy, but bringing them back to Canada was an ordeal. With William McGregor acting as driver and a guide, Murray visited farms throughout the Otonabee area, gathering whatever information he could on the late David Scully and the Grays. By good luck, he found one household that had received a letter from the Grays. It was postmarked Ocala, Florida. Murray had extradition papers prepared, then boarded a train for the South. Murray had no trouble finding Thomas and Hessie. They had squandered the money they'd received from David Scully's farm and were living in a squalor in a shanty town. The children were hungry and half-naked, and infants, several months old, had increased the brood to 6. Murray couldn't arrest the parents and leave the children on their own, so he took the whole family into custody and put them on a train. It would be the worst railroad journey of Murray's life. The moment the train started, Murray wrote, Mrs. Gray began to boo-hoo, and the 6 little Grays burst forth into a chorus of caterwauling, and Thomas Gray blubbered, while Tommy Gray opened up his cave of the winds and poured forth loud howls. I have traveled many miles with many prisoners, but never did I have such a cargo and such a trip. It was a long series of snorings and shriekings. When they were awake, they howled, and when they were asleep, they snored. And Tommy Gray kicked in his sleep and had dreams that called for wild acrobatic feats. It was stifling hot weather, too, and the presence of the Grays could be detected even by a blind man if his olfactory organ did even half of its duty. A haggard and wary Detective Murray arrived with his charge at Peterborough on July 5, 1895. 11 days later, Thomas and Hesse were arraigned in police court on charges of murder, arson, and fraud. Hesse had her baby in her arms. Thomas still appeared stupid-looking, but Hesse seemed unconcerned, though attentive to the proceedings. She smiled and nodded to acquaintances in the crowded room, and nudged her husband with her elbow whenever a witness said something that caught her interest. A reporter from the Toronto Globe wrote, "It was difficult to believe he had been guilty of the diabolical and deliberate crime charged." Nonetheless, the court decided that the Crown had a case for murder. The Gray's trial began on September 26th before Chancellor John Boyd. Farmers drove in from miles around to see the drama. The couple were to be tried separately. Hesse's case came first. From the moment Hesse Gray appeared in the dock with a babe in her arms, she had the sympathy of the audience, the very people who gossiped about murder a year and a half earlier. Could a mother commit so bloodily a deed as cutting off a man's head? It helped Hesse's cause, too, that she no longer had that defiant attitude she had displayed in the police court. Now she looked pale and concerned. At first, things did not look promising for Hesse. Her sister Mary told the court about the threat to cut off Scully's head and burn down the house. Willie McGregor said that he had heard his sister-in-law talk 1,000 times about poisoning the old brute. McGregor further testified that Thomas once told him he, Thomas, had the best little woman in Canada. She knew how to get rid of the damned old brute when he, Thomas, was out of the way. McGregor said that after the fire, Thomas confided in him that when he set out for Madoc, he never expected to see Scully alive again. And if only the head hadn't been missing, it would have been all right. Mary McGregor hinted, perhaps unintentionally, that the relationship between the Grays and the McGregors was not exactly harmonious. When she said she would have visited her sister more frequently if William had permitted her to do so. A boy testified that the day before the fire, he had seen a lot of blood on the floor of Scully's barn. The defense explained that some days prior to that, Thomas had been slaughtering hogs. Burnham stated that if Hesse had alerted him immediately, he probably would have been able to get the Scully out of the house. The strongest testimony for the Crown was that of Dr. Cavan. He said it was not possible that David Scully was still alive when the fire reached him. He did not believe it was possible that the fire could entirely consume the head, yet leave the rest of the body relatively untouched, unless head and torso had been separated before the fire. But he had to admit there were no blood stains on the clothing he had seen on Scully's exhumed remains, and he could not swear that the bones of the neck had been cut by a sharp instrument. As far as the defense was concerned, the threats Hesse had made against Scully's life, if in fact she had made them, were not proof she had murdered the old man. Nor did the discovery of the body in the wrong part of the house prove anything. Counsel argued there was absolutely no evidence that Scully was actually in his bedroom when the fire started. If anyone wondered why old Davy would have gone to sleep in the cold cellar on a February night, the question was not raised. It could only have led to speculation. Hesse's oldest children, Annie 13 and Tommy 11, won her case for her. Annie told the court that on the night of the fire, she had gone to bed between 10 and 11 o'clock. She said the whole family slept in the same downstairs room. The last she saw of Mr. Scully, he was sitting by the kitchen stove holding one of the smaller children. She woke in the middle of the night in a room full of smoke. She wakened her mother, who opened the door to find the kitchen ablaze. Her mother found her father's axe behind the bureau and used it to smash the window. Her mother then put all of the children outside. Annie said they did not go to Mr. Burnham's house because he was a rich man and we didn't have much on. Yeah. Tommy's testimony supported Annie's. He added that the last he saw Mr. Scully, the old man, was sitting in his bed reading by the lamplight. Both children spoke in a straightforward manner with no sign of nervousness. Chancellor Boyd was so impressed with what he considered the truthful accounts of the children, he stopped the trial. He told the defense it was unnecessary for them to call 7 or 8 remaining witnesses. He then proposed that the jury enter a verdict of not guilty. The gentlemen of the jury happily acquiesced. They were all well aware that the public sentiment was on Hesse's side. The murder charge against Thomas was dropped, as were all other charges against the couple. 4 months later, the Grays were still in the Peterborough area, trying to sue witnesses who had testified against them for slander. One can only wonder if they were once again guests in the McGregor's home. Did old Davy die in the fire? Hesse's defense suggested that he could have been killed by poisonous fumes, which would account for the peaceful position of his body. As for the relatively intact conditions of the corpse, aside from the head, stranger things have been found in the aftermath of a fire. Or did Hesse get up after the children had gone to bed, decapitated Scully, and leave his body in the cellar? Certain it would be reduced to ash? If Hesse really intended to murder Scully, would she actually have pulled her sister? If Mary was lying about the threats, what was her motive? Was McGregor telling the truth when he testified that Thomas said of Hesse, he knew how to get rid of the damned old brute? So that was a bit longer of a story than I expected. So that's not going to be a regular thing on the podcast, but will be from time to time. So here are my podcast reviews for this week. So to begin, I have a few podcasts that I'd like to recommend. Number one, the Big Seance podcast. I have to admit, this is the very first podcast I'd listened to. The host, Patrick Keller, is a joy to listen to as he talks to many guests who are all in some way connected to the paranormal world. Number two, the History Goes Bump podcast. I highly recommend this podcast. The ladies are really wonderful and make you feel like you're actually sitting there with them. This podcast is entirely listener-supported, so you don't get those pesky ads. Number three, The Lift. It is an audio drama based on a creepily cute little girl named Victoria. Want to take a ride on Victoria's Lift? Follow along with all the great stories by many authors. This is another podcast that is listener-supported. Those are the top three podcasts that I have personally listened to and would highly recommend to anyone. I have a bunch more that I'm listening to right now that I will review in later podcasts. Thank you. Before I go, I would like to give a big shout-out to Diane Denise from the History Goes Bump podcast. If it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be doing this podcast. They brought me out of my comfort zone. If you want to listen to a podcast that combines history and hauntings, then definitely listen to History Goes Bump. Thanks for joining me on episode 1. Please stay tuned for episode 2 next Wednesday or Thursday. If there's anything you would like me to talk about, please reach out to me at saltycanadian2017@gmail.com. Also, don't forget to follow me on Facebook, The Salty Canadian, Twitter, at saltycanadian2017. Also, join my Facebook group called The Salty Canadian Podcast Rant Room. I can also be found on Google Play Music, as well as Apple Podcasts. Please make sure you leave a review for me. Have a great day, eh?
Morning starts anew, and with a shiny dew, everything's covered. The sunny sky is clear, the darkness is not here, the new day is coming.